episode 9. Welcome to episode 9 of the Thinking Habits podcast. I've tried to do this intro once already this morning. Turns out I can't speak without coffee. I should know that by now. So hopefully this one will go a little bit better. Today's chat is absolutely fascinating. It's a wonderful chat. We've been trying to line this up for a little while. I've known Katie for several years. Katie is a mental health nurse like myself, although I've known them since before they started their training. So it's quite an interesting sort of recap for us to go through that. The conversation today touches on ADHD and autistic spectrum disorders, but it is definitely a part one of probably more than two, really, because it only covers part of the story. So it's sort of early aspects of ADHD as a child, up to the point of qualifying as a mental health nurse, and the issues that has caused Katie during that time. And one thing that Katie was very, very keen to mention after we had this first chat was that we didn't really touch on the positive aspects of ADHD, and that's something that that they were very keen to stress that there is some, and we will definitely be covering that. So please bear that in mind when you're listening to it. But it's an absolutely fascinating chat, and incredibly frank, forthright, really fascinating as to how minds work. And so I'm going to let this chat speak for itself, because it's an absolutely belting chat, and I'm looking forward to parts 2, 3, 4 and however many more there are, because there will be a lot. So enjoy this chat, and I'll catch up at the end. Found it?
Yeah.
Brilliant. Ready when you are. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Cool. Katie, thank you for joining us on episode, I think it's going to be episode 9 of Thinking Habits. That's gone quick. So should we just start? Do you want to sort of introduce yourself? And
So I'm Katie. I was first diagnosed with ADHD when I was 10. And I started taking medication for it then, but my parents took me off the medication because they were really concerned about the side effects. When I was about 13 or 14, and I pretty much managed without it, not getting as good results at school as I was expected to, and the usual. Did my A-levels badly, went to university to do photography, because at the time I thought, if I'm going to get myself into several thousand pounds of debt, it might as well be something fun. I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life at that time.
Yeah.
And ended up dropping out of the photography degree 2.5 years later, struggling with my mental health, and a combination of being bullied all the way through school and my stepdad dying when I was in my second year, and just not being able to cope with the coursework and functioning as an adult living on their own and things. Bounced between job to job, and then when I was about 25-ish, I think, I decided to retrain as a paramedic, because I'd been volunteering with St John Ambulance, and I'd been sort of considering what I was going to do with my life. And then about 2 months later, the NHS bursary for paramedics got cut, so I couldn't do it anymore, because it was just, I couldn't afford to do it, because I already had a degree and a student loan and everything else, so I couldn't.
It's unobtainable, isn't it?
Yeah. So then I started looking at what else I could do, because at that point I'd kind of attached myself to, I was going to work in healthcare, I was going to pay back the favour to the NHS for helping fix me after years of just getting me from the point where I barely could get out of bed to the point where I was thinking about a career. And then I thought nursing, and then I thought, started looking around at the different, and I knew a couple of mental health nurses, but it was only when I went and looked at the university websites and discovered that actually you chose, before you started your training, what field to specialise in that I decided I was going to train to become a mental health nurse. And literally pay back the NHS for the support they'd given me with my mental health. So I started applying in the November, and 5 months later I started university. It was all a bit of a whirlwind.
I remember that, because I remember talking to you about it. That was all very exciting, and I remember sort of how sort of between anxious and fearful you were at the time.
Yeah.
I can totally empathise with that, because I kind of made the decision and then started very soon after as well.
So, well, I actually applied for the September intake in the November of the previous year.
Yeah.
But then when I got my own and it was a conditional offer based on providing my GCSE results to the university, so it was essentially an unconditional offer. When I got the offer, it was just it was specifically for the March intake, and they said to me, you can come in the March intake or you can come in the September intake, whichever you like. And I was just like, that's how I was unemployed, and just went, you know what, I've got nothing nothing to lose, so
why wait 6 months?
Yeah,
you can just do it now. Yeah,
yeah. I actually remember the day that I woke up and rolled over and saw the email of UCAS,
yeah,
and that had come in overnight, and because they must have made the offer sort of late on in the day before, and I'd, in my obsessive several times a day checking of the UCAS website, it had happened before I woke up, but after the most recent time I checked.
Yeah.
I think by that point, because it had only been about a month since I'd had my interview, I'd managed to try and limit myself to checking like 2 or 3 times a day, because it was just getting unhealthy. They UCAS sent out the emails at about midnight or whatever, you know, anything that had happened in the previous 24 hours or whatever. And I rolled over and I saw the email, and I clicked through and I saw that I'd got the offer, and I ran downstairs so fast. My bedroom was in the loft, my mum was downstairs on sort of the ground floor of the house. She heard me come in a mile off, obviously, and she yelled, "Slow down, elephant," at me, because of the noise I was making running down the stairs. I was like, "I'm going to uni in March."
Oh, fantastic.
I was just so happy,
because an awful lot of work's gone into the that point, hadn't it? Yeah. So at that time, were you back on meds for ADHD? Had you gone back on again?
No, I went to uni, and I lasted about a week and a half before I went home and I sat down at the kitchen table and was like, I don't think I'm gonna have to drop out, because I can't concentrate. I can, you know. Basically, I did the week of they called it a learning to learn week, which was amazing at the start of every single year.
Yeah.
They did a week of, this is the kind of thing that's expected of you at this level of study, and it was so perfect.
I wish they'd done that for us. Thrown in.
yeah, they told us, yeah, this is level 4 study, this is level 5 study, this is level 6 study at the start of each year, and giving you examples and things like that, and showing you the difference between, you know, your analytical study and descriptive and everything else.
Yeah.
It was great. So I'd done that week, that was fine, and then they threw us into the heavy anatomy lectures, and
I
hated science at school. Biology was the only one I was vaguely interested in, but yeah, I hated science. And it turns out that maybe the real reasons I hated was because it was just so complex and trying to concentrate on it. I sat down at the kitchen table and I said, I think I'm going to have to drop out of this one as well, because I just can't focus for more than 20 minutes. And my mum goes, maybe it's the ADHD. And I went, what ADHD? Because in an ADHD trope of sorts, I'd forgotten I had ADHD.
Right. It'd been quite a long time. You've got your meds and...
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, when I was about 14, when I stopped taking them, because basically I had to be prompted to take my meds by my parents anyway. I never even noticed I'd stopped taking them.
Right. You just kind of got out of that.
Yeah. So yeah, 12 years later, I didn't even know I had ADHD anymore. Yeah. So that was a bit of a revelation.
Wow, yeah.
I went to my doctor. I went to the University Disability Service first and showed them all of my previous stuff, because my mum had dug out all the previous stuff that said, yeah, I had ADHD and everything else. And, you know, the school reports saying that my school teachers could see the difference in me post and pre-meds.
Right.
And they were like, okay, well, this is good enough for us. They immediately gave me a digital recorder for my lectures, just loan that to me for several months while I got stuff sorted. But they said, you're going to apply for DSA and stuff, you're going to have, the Disabled Students Lounge, you're going to have to get a new diagnosis, an up-to-date one.
Yeah.
This is good enough for us. If you're still experiencing the same problems and you've got an old diagnosis, then as an interim, we gave, they gave me that. And they insisted that the lecturers put all the slides on Blackboard before the lecture so that I had an opportunity to print them off. So that I could make notes on stuff without having to write down everything that was on the slide and just the bits that weren't on the slide.
Because that can be really so hard, can't it? Because some lecturers go at different speeds, don't they? And sometimes you can, you're okay with it. And sometimes,
especially in anatomy and biology, so I don't have to draw diagrams of the body anymore.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whilst trying to listen and write everything down.
Yeah.
So it was just, it was brilliant to have that. I went to my GP and I really looked out, because at the time I was on my first placement. By the time I'd got the GP appointment, because it was 2 or 3 weeks, we wait for that. And the one of, I ended up at the initial assessment team for my first placement, because they did it as like a 2 week placement 5 weeks into the course, followed by an
just
8 week
your
placement
toe in, isn't it?
And I get the feeling it was kind of designed to weed out the people who weren't going to stick around.
I had that same feeling. My first placement was 4 weeks, but you had like a sort of 5 day gap in the middle, so I kind of did it slightly differently. But there, a few people dropped out just even then because they went, actually, this is not for me.
Yeah, it was a 2 week placement followed by 8 weeks at the same placement again about 2 months later for us. So it was a 10 week placement in total, but split up over a couple of months. So this first placement, I was talking to someone and I'd said, could I possibly, you know, I need to be in a bit late on this day because I've got a doctor's appointment. And I was just talking about it with one of the other nurses and they were like, you seem a bit worried, you know, the usual kind of mental health nurse thing of just kind of, and just as a really weird tangent sort of thing, I ended up re-meeting that nurse on my final placement.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's lovely. It comes full circle.
Yeah, and yeah, so they were like, the difference in you is incredible.
Because of course they started on the treatment.
I was like, I know you from somewhere, I couldn't remember where, and then after about 3 weeks, he realised that he knew where he knew me from.
Right.
And he was like, hang on a minute, didn't you do a placement at this place?
So did, he identify the fact that you were nervous about going? Was that
nervous about going, because I was like, I didn't know if the doctor was going to listen to me and so on. Anyway, with the help of this nurse who basically just found the nice guidelines on ADHD for me, highlighted all the relevant bits about if you've got a childhood diagnosis and you're still suffering as an adult or experiencing it as an adult, then you are automatically entitled to a new assessment and things like that. He highlighted all of that for me. He even found the medication treatment stuff for me.
That's brilliant.
And printed out the relevant pages from the online BNF for me. Sweet. And just said, like, show your GP all of this. Show your GP that you are entitled to an assessment, and you know your GP can't do anything about it. You know, he's got to then refer you. Showed up to the GP appointment. My GP had rung in sick, so I ended up with a locum who was just like, yeah, okay, right, nice guidelines. I'll just follow those.
Right.
Referred me to the crisis team. The crisis team went, this isn't an appropriate referral. Took it in the bin and didn't say anything to anyone.
Right, so not, so it just went, it just disappeared into the ether.
It just disappeared into the ether.
Superb.
So 4 weeks later, I contacted the GP and I was like, what's, you know, I've not heard anything yet, what's happened? Because, you know, they agreed to refer me and what's going on?
Yeah.
So the receptionist then called me back and was like, yeah, I've investigated it and we've investigated it and you were just referred to the crisis team and because it wasn't an appropriate referral, they've not done anything with it.
It's so demoralising, isn't it?
Yeah. So they were like, okay, we're just going to re-refer it. You don't need to come back in. We're going to re-refer you to the appropriate place. And yeah, basically, that was in, that all started in May. In August, I get an appointment for the end of November.
Oh my God.
For a doctor in Liverpool, because the area I was living in at the time didn't have a consultant for adult ADHD, only for children. If I'd been a child, then I could have gone to the hospital 10 minutes walk from my house.
That's even worse, isn't it?
Yeah, but I ended up going to, fortunately, with having a 2 or 3 month notice, I managed to get cheap train tickets.
Oh, that's cool. that's something at least.
Yeah.
Something at least. So you got your referral. Was it a straightforward referral? Did you have to go right from scratch? Did they take the
Yeah, I showed to the appointment with school reports. I'd done the self-rating questionnaire that you can get. Mm. I did a 2 week sort of symptom diary just before the appointment, which included wonderful things like showing up to the library at 6 in the morning to do some last minute, because I had an exam 2 days before the appointment. Mm. So I'd shown up at the library at 6 in the morning.
Yeah.
Without my ID card, so I could get into the library.
Yeah.
So fortunately, they recognised, the librarians recognised me because I had that rainbow woolen hat on.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
So they recognised me by my hat and still let me in the library anyway.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Common sense as well.
That's good. So I sat there in the library for about 4 hours, and then I showed up to the door and I was like, "So I want to take these books home with me because I've not brought any food with me either." Mm. I said, "I can't. I need to go home and get my library card. I'll be back in an hour. Can I just leave these books here?" Mm. And that's when the common sense began to fail, because they said, "Well, we can't hide these books from someone else and stop them from taking them out." And I was like, "But if I had my card, I'd be taking them home with me now."
Yeah.
So that would be hiding them in my house. Yeah. How is this different? And once I said this to them, they were like, "Oh, yeah, okay." Yeah. So they let me hide them behind the counter until I came back an hour later with my ID card.
And realistically, they could have put your ID through without a card. It's not, you know, library systems aren't.
Apparently they couldn't. Mm.
Yeah.
They can check books back in without your card.
Funny that.
Yeah.
Funny that.
Can't let you take them away.
I'm sure we might get a comment on the email saying, "Well, actually, you can't." But yeah, I don't know the system, so I'm not going to judge.
It was a difficult few months without it. Mm. But yeah, then once I got the diagnosis, I got the DSA funding for a tutor who managed to help me sit down and proofread things and notice all the missing grammar. And all she was allowed to do was highlight it and say there's something wrong here, but not. And she told me what it was, so then I had to, of course, because I did know what was wrong, I'd just not noticed it myself. So it was like a highlight of there's something missing here.
Mm.
Then it was like, then I could go and correct it, kind of thing.
So to sort of circle back a little bit, because my understanding of ADHD is somewhat limited. So from what I'm getting from what you're saying is that your main, certainly while you were studying, your main symptoms were that you got easily distracted, you jump from subject to subject, or you don't necessarily finish things in, is it like broken thought kind of thing? Right.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, now that I've qualified, I'd probably best liken it to flight of ideas.
I wasn't going to put all words of those. In, but that's what popped in, yeah.
Yeah. Like, if I wouldn't be entirely surprised if I could get a hold of my reports off my consultant, then, the flight of ideas would be very evident or something like that. But, yeah.
But that makes sense when you hear when kids are diagnosed with ADHD. When I worked with young adults who came through to the prison who'd had a diagnosis of ADHD right the way through, and they were literally... They couldn't keep on one topic for more than a couple of seconds.
Yeah.
And the problem with them, the problem they had further is that they were in a group of people who bounced off each other. So that then became a very volatile environment because it's just like rubber balls just bouncing all over the place. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and I use the word neurotypical basically to refer to anyone who, you know, that magical group of people that have never experienced any kind of mental health at all. So I don't just mean people who are on the autistic spectrum or whatever, but, you know, even somebody who has not experienced depression or anxiety or to any kind of significant degree. So when I say neurotypical people often have an attention span of maybe 25 to 30 minutes at a time.
Mm.
Mine is at best about 3 or 4 minutes.
Wow.
Until now, I've never managed to listen to a podcast without getting distracted. Yours is the first one I've managed to actually listen to.
Bless you.
I do still have to listen to, like, jump back a few minutes at a time sometimes and go, hang on a minute.
I'll
be listening to it and then my mind will just go whoosh off in some direction.
I do exactly the same.
Yeah.
Exactly the same.
So, yeah, if something pricks my imagination, then I'll just be like, hang on a minute, how much have I just missed? And I go That jump back 15 seconds at a time thing is amazing, because I can just tap it about four or five times. Like, have I listened to this bit? No, I've not heard this bit. Jump back a bit more.
I think I'm my own worst enemy sometimes with podcasts, because I tend to listen to them while I'm doing something else.
Yeah.
And so...
I've quickly figured out that I can't do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't listen. I can listen to music at the same time I'm doing something else.
Yeah.
Because it's music I know, and unless I'm trying to listen to music to kind of centre myself...
Yes.
I can't listen to... But then if I'm trying to listen to music to centre myself, I'm not doing something else at the same time.
Absolutely, of course.
Yeah. But I can't listen to things like spoken word. I've never listened to an audiobook.
Right.
Ever.
Right.
Well, I started listening to one when I had an Audible free trial at one point, and I gave up about halfway through the book because it was just like...
Just because it, it just was can't. Just focusing on that one thing.
Yeah,
wow.
Because I just couldn't see. It was going to... I very, very quickly realised, because I can read with Anak. And the thing is, as well, on top of the weird thing of just like, I can't keep my focus for more than 3 or 4 minutes, there is also hyper-focusing, where if actually something gets my attention and it's... Because ADHD used to be considered part of the autistic spectrum, so I suppose it's a bit like the niche interest thing.
Mm.
If something does get my attention, then I can, say, sit and read a book for 3, 4, 5 hours at a time, and if you say something to me, I won't hear you.
Oh, so it's to the exclusion of all else.
Yeah.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
So, yeah, so if I was reading that book, that'd be fine.
Can you be straight in?
But done? Listening to the book, can't do it.
Right. It's fascinating.
Yeah,
fascinating.
And yeah, it's about playing to your strengths. So I know that, for example, so similarly with, and weirdly, ebooks I can do as fiction, can't do ebooks as non-fiction.
Really?
Have to have a textbook.
Oh, that's interesting. See, non-fiction I always do is audiobooks.
Which is how I ended up in the library at 6 a.m.
It makes perfect sense.
Even in 2013, when you've got like ebooks and things, you know, they had an entire online library and I could have sat at home 45 minutes away.
But you needed the physical text.
I'd used the online textbooks before I went into the library, and I had a list of all the page numbers I needed to look at, because I'd been sat up all night revising anyway.
Right.
So I had a list of the page numbers I needed to look at that I haven't been able to properly focus on because they've been on my computer screen.
So is that an element... I don't know if this sounds naive, but is that an element of dyslexia as well? Is there a?
I don't have dyslexia. No. You've never seen my handwriting.
No, never seen handwriting.
We've only ever
communicated electronically. Oh wow! So
that's not my handwriting.
I was going to say
that's just the front cover.
Oh right, okay. Jesus.
That's how I could never be a doctor.
That is copper. No, you're absolutely right. This,
people frequently tell me it looks like I've printed it from a computer.
It's copperplate. It's absolutely incredible. I might take a photo of one with your permission just to show how incredibly detailed and amazing this is. Wow. God, I might read through this myself just to brush up on a few things. This is brilliant. So you went, just to circle back, actually, just to grab something from what you said. You said it used to be part of the autistic spectrum. Is it not anymore?
No.
No.
It's been pulled out of the autistic spectrum and made its own diagnosis.
Right. And what's the rationale behind that? Is that just because it doesn't fit enough of the criteria to remain there, or?
I think it's basically because there's so many comorbidities that it's a lot of people with ADHD have something on the autistic spectrum as well.
Yeah.
Including myself, I found out when I was 5 years after I got the ADHD diagnosis that I have autistic spectrum disorder as well.
Right.
Which I specifically choose because of the recent-ish now news about Asperger being a Nazi, basically.
Right.
I actually used to prefer the term Asperger's syndrome because syndrome is versus disorder.
Yeah.
And you know the stigma attached to it, because disorder versus syndrome,
absolutely, yeah.
You know, there's something not working there. Mm. But now that I know that actually Asperger practice eugenics, I'm kind of like, yeah, maybe not.
Maybe let's distance ourselves from that.
Yeah. So if it was Asperger's spectrum conditions or something, I'd massively prefer it. But no, they've gone with ASD. But
fair enough.
But yeah, I found out when I was 30 that I'm a classic case of somebody who was socialised as female.
Right.
Apparently, I went into that assessment so nervous that I was going to get told, "No, you don't have autism," and that basically all of the social stuff that I struggle with is entirely my own fault and things like that. That's one of the benefits of labels, I think. It means that you can stop blaming yourself for stuff that's wrong, you know. Again, when I was diagnosed with ADHD, I also went into that assessment really nervous that I'd be told, no, you've grown out of it, you just suck.
But then also with concomitant to all of these things is if you've got underlying anxiety or depression related symptoms or, you know, disorders, to use that phrase, the tendency to catastrophise goes hand in hand with all of that. So you go from worry will automatically put you in peril, regardless of whether or not that peril is genuine. And I certainly empathise with that, because I go to the, you know, I'm already preparing for the apocalypse if I get, you know, a piece of brown mail. God knows what that is. You know, you think, oh God, it could be a bill, it could be, you know, a court summons or whatever. You don't know until you open it.
Yeah.
But it can be something as simple as that, and something as important.
I've actually got friends who, with various mental health issues and stuff, who refer to brown envelopes of doom as being the ones from the DWP, because they know exactly what the exact shade of brown, the address on the back of the envelope that is a DWP envelope, and you never know whether it's going to be good news or bad news.
No, and that instills you with an absolute terror before you even read it. It could be something good, couldn't it? Very, very, very interesting. So in terms of the support that you get for ADHD and for ASD as well, do they gel? Do they cross over? Do you have similar kind of support mechanisms for that? Or are they
no, not really. Disparate? ADHD is medicated.
Mm-hmm.
ADHD is one of those, both of those things, both ADHD and ASD, they're diagnosed by discussion, really. There isn't although you've been on the internet long enough to see the brain scan thing.
Yes, absolutely.
This is someone with ADHD, and this is someone without, and this is what the brain's different. And I've never actually managed to find out if that is actually the brain of someone with ADHD. I've looked, but I can't find out if that is someone with ADHD or not.
The only one I've ever been able to kind of confirm is that one where the guy did the what was it? He did brain scans of psychopaths. And then he did his own brain scan, and they did a blind trial, and they picked him out as a psychopath. And basically he had to reflect on it, well, actually, yeah, I suppose I am, really.
But I can't remember exactly where it was, about how so many people have psychopathic traits, and it's like, and actually, you know, having psychopathic traits versus being a psychopath really, you know, actually, plus, like, for example, you've got to be kind of psychopathic to be a surgeon.
Yes.
To be able to pick up a scalpel and cut into someone.
Absolutely. And they, and they talk about the levels of psychopathy in surgery and neurosurgery. And then obviously you've got the tropes of the, you know, the square mile in London and, you know, the big city bankers and stuff. But there are certain jobs.
When you think about a surgeon, who everybody looks upon, emergency surgeons are obviously, you know, even more kind of highly revered than everyone, but especially a general surgeon, where you're not doing it in an emergency and you've not got the adrenaline to help you do it, to be able to pick up a scalpel and cut into someone who
to be completely divorced and treat that as an object.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then, but surgeons are such good people in society, and yet they must have psychopathic traits.
And yet, you know as well as I do, when you get to that level, my experience of working and speaking to surgeons is their bedside manner's not great. They often get the junior doctors to do their bedside manner stuff because their brain is elsewhere. Their brain is in the surgery. And it doesn't surprise me at all that there's a level of psychopathy there.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, if I have to go under the knife,
I'd rather be under the knife from a psychopath than someone who might get nervous and
absolutely,
make the scalpel slip.
Somebody with empathy that starts wobbling. No, we don't want that. We don't want that at all.
Where were we?
We were.
This is what ADHD is like. Completely forgot what we were talking about.
No, this is a perfectly natural, organic conversation. It's absolutely brilliant. And what I was going to say was, so you qualified and you got through university with the help of your tutor and the medication. Which medication was it? Because the one I know of is Ritalin's one of them, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And then there's another one.
There's several others. I started on the long acting version of Ritalin, which the actual drug name is methylphenidate.
That's the one. Yeah.
So methylphenidate is Ritalin,
right?
And then you've got the extended release of methylphenidate, which is Concerta or Concerta XL.
Yeah.
So I initially started on that on the basis that I'd had Ritalin and it had worked.
Mm.
And I was fine for about 6 months.
Mm.
And then you may remember I came to you in about 6 or 7 months after that when they titrated me up too fast with massive anxiety problems. And I was just what do I do? And that's when you put me onto mindfulness.
Yeah.
Which I've got something like I think it's only about a 2-year streak nowadays on Headspace.
On Headspace, is it?
But I lost my streak about a year or so after that. But one of the things with ADHD and autism and stuff, I love the pattern and just having that streak is what keeps me going on it in a way.
I'm the same with
even though I know the benefits of it.
Yeah,
actually, the thing that keeps me going is keeping my streak going.
But if you've got a hook, if that streak gets you to sit down and have that time, then you get the time. Yeah. So one way or another, you're winning, aren't you?
Yeah,
you're winning. That's brilliant.
But one of the many weird things about ADHD is they treat it with stimulants, which is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
I always find that amazing.
Turns out the reason that they stumbled across this is basically they looked at people who had ADHD and how they self-medicated and discovered that they self-medicated using speed.
Right.
So then they formulated a version of speed which is safe for people to... Yeah, that is a controlled dosage each day.
Yeah, and when you're titrating, do you from the first tablet? Do you definitely feel?
Yeah, my mum noticed within 30 minutes of taking the first tablet that I started. I decided just to test it out. Yeah. I didn't tell her of the first day that I started taking it.
Yeah,
because she didn't know when I picked it up from the pharmacy.
Right.
And she said something to me within an hour of me taking it, going, "You've started taking that medication, haven't you?"
Really?
Yeah.
Because you just calmed down and just
settled. Slowed right down.
Right.
She noticed that first morning.
Wow, that's a profound change to go through.
I think she vaguely made the connection to what I was like when I was younger as well.
Right.
Because, of course, she'd seen me on medication before.
Okay. But so what side effects was she worried about that would make them want you to come off it? Was it less understood then? Or?
Yeah, but also... actually putting, and I think maybe I was on too high a dose when I was a kid, and the difference when I was on too high a dose as an adult versus too high a dose as a child was quite different.
Right.
The way I can describe it as a child is I was very much kind of zombie-like.
Right.
I had a almost a panic attack if I'd... Weirdly, I still forgot stuff a lot. So I was much more focused and calm and less anxious and able to concentrate on lessons, but I still forgot stuff I'd done.
Right.
So, for example, I would put bread into the toast. This is an actual example. I put bread into the toaster, turned around, started doing something else, and nearly jumped out of my life when the toaster popped up.
Because you just completely...
Just completely forgot. So then the toaster popping up scared the life out of me.
God.
The phone would ring and I would jump out of my skin and things like that, and I became much more nervous and jumpy in that sense. I wasn't socially anxious anymore, but I was much more jumpy because I was on a stimulant. So that's what it was like when I was about 14.
And you've got enough to deal with when you're 14.
As an adult, I became socially anxious instead.
Right.
When I was so more socially anxious than I was without the meds.
Yeah.
Because I started on an 18 milligram dose, which after a week went up to 36 milligrams. After about 2 or 3 months, we pushed me up to 54 milligrams.
And that's when you rang me.
And that's when I ended up ringing you or sending you a message and going, help. Or about a week after that. Because I was just like, I can't, I'm just not functioning and I feel awful all the time and everything else. And I was just, I was in a mess. About 2 months after that, I got pulled back down to 36, long enough to get myself sorted out, and then I went up to 45, which was the happy medium for about a year until I developed a tolerance to them. Obviously I developed a tolerance to, but I developed such a tolerance to them that I was becoming scatterbrained again.
Right.
So I developed a tolerance to them probably after about 2 or 3 months, but I could cope with tolerance for the first, for a while. But 45 milligrams is a weird enough dose that I had to take 2 tablets every morning because even the manufacturer didn't make it.
The manufacturer
makes 9 milligrams,
18 milligrams,
36 milligrams, and 54 milligrams, but does not make 45 milligrams as a dose.
I had to work that
18 and 36. I took. But and then I ended up on 45 in the morning and 36 in the afternoon. It was meant to be 36 in the morning and 45 in the afternoon, and then I quickly figured out that mornings were harder than afternoons, so I just switched it around.
At the end of the day, it's like with Pam's medication for her MS, the doctor, after 10 years of being diagnosed, the doctor says to her, what do you think would work?
Yeah.
And I think when you get a good consultant or a good doctor, and you can manage that, and they're more than happy to work with you on that.
Yeah,
that makes
my consultant's been very much like that, and my GP as well. Just kind of the GP still wrote the prescriptions for this amount in the morning, this amount in the afternoon, and I just ignored it. I was still taking the same dosage each day. I just took it in a way that worked for me.
Absolutely.
And my consultant was like, fine. And my GP was just doing what my consultant said, because my GP actually had that understanding of. I've had GPs since I started, because I've had about 3 different GPs since I started my ADHD treatment. And the one GP when I first started, they were very funny about it, and they wouldn't do the renewals because it was a controlled drug.
Right.
They wouldn't do the renewals without my consultant sending them a fax, because, of course, at the NHS.
Reliant on faxes.
Yeah.
As we said.
It was in the news this week.
It was, wasn't it? Yeah,
there's too many fax machines. I remember when I learned how to use a fax machine as a student nurse, I was just posted a Facebook status. Today at uni, I learned how to use a fax machine.
And it was what? That was like 2012 or 2013.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah, the hospital where I'm working at the moment, there's hundreds of faxes. And thousands of actual faxes go through every day still.
Unfortunately, we have a ward admin to do that now. I've not had to use a fax machine in months now.
fair enough. They'll all be gone soon, I'm sure. Yeah. So you found your happy medium for a little while, and you've got yourself on your meds. And then, obviously, you started work. You qualified and got a job.
Yeah.
How did you find... Because for me, when I left uni and I started working... Huge culture shock, because you're a nurse now. You've got to learn how to actually nurse, as opposed to being a student nurse, and that filled me with anxiety. And I didn't have the extra issues to deal with that you had. So how did that?
Actually, it hit me a year before that.
Really, you prepared a year early?
No, even that. I had my year out.
Yeah.
Because of the various different issues and just stress levels at uni and stuff. I had a year out because I had an allegation made against me, which was obviously found to not, by the fact that I'm now a nurse, was obviously found to not actually be, have happened.
But that can cause enormous stress, can't it?
Yeah. Interestingly, on the day that the incident that I was accused of had supposedly occurred, I'd actually been, as a second year student, sent out to do an ADHD assessment on a child on my own, which shouldn't have happened.
Right.
As a second year student, I should have been supervised.
Absolutely.
It's all interconnected in weird ways. Mm. It was a CAMHS outpatient placement that I was doing at the time. Mm. They'd used my expertise in that area to kind of... to help them, and I mean, I had the support when I got back to the office.
Yeah, but it's
realistically,
still
I should have had a nurse with me.
Still naughty.
Which thankfully the university recognised as well. But so I had my year out whilst the university dealt with it, and sort of just made sure that I was still fit to continue being a nurse and everything else, which fully respect them for. If I'd made an allegation against someone, I'd want to see them properly investigated as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
So
belt and braces works.
I wish it had taken a little bit less time. But
absolutely, yeah, I'm sure.
It was investigated for 8 months in the end.
That's a long time.
Yeah, which, again, they recognised they'd taken too long because the policy says 20 working days.
Mm. That's a lot more.
Yeah, a lot more. Yeah. In the meantime, I did manage to get a job with someone who believed my side of the story, because I was working as a PA for a disabled person in my year out. So somebody who believed my side of the story and was happy to take me on, because I'm not going into details about the allegation, but I did have to have an interview with the police about it. And the police had decided within 15 minutes that there was no case to answer.
A load of nonsense.
So based on that, this person was happy to give me a job for the year, that, and slightly more than the year I ended up doing, essentially bank work for them.
Right.
Even after I went back to uni. In fact, technically, I'm still on the payroll. So,
oh, yeah. Fantastic.
So that was in 2015. Mm. So it was, yeah. 300 bit years later, I do fill in now and again.
Oh, well, that's good.
But yeah. So I had my job out of uni. And about halfway through that year, I got moved from the consultant that against. I went to an appointment with my consultant, the consultant that diagnosed me, and he said to me, they're doing a bit of a sort of service reorganisation, and because you live on the Cheshire side of the patch, rather than the Merseyside side of the patch, because it was Cheshire and Wirral Partnership that he worked for,
right?
They're looking at moving you to another consultant.
Right.
How do you feel about that?
Mm.
And I was like, not great. Mm. I feel like, you know, and of course I started using the technological terms at him. I was like, I feel like we've got a good therapeutic relationship and stuff.
Yeah.
I don't really want to go and, you know, move to someone different.
Well, you don't have to start again.
Exactly. So the next time I get an appointment, it had been taken out of his hands. I had been moved to the other consultant, even though I didn't want to be. Mm. And I went to see that consultant who, one of the other things to note about the previous consultant is, on the basis it had taken me so long to get the referral and to get to go and see him, he said even though once I was stable, he was happy to just see me once every 6 months, maybe even move to telephone consultations, rather than expect me to trek over to Liverpool from Manchester.
Just to check in.
Just to make sure I was okay, so that I had a fast and easy way of getting back into the service if I needed it.
Got it. Right.
Once it was taken out of his hands and I was moved to another consultant, the other consultant went, well, you're settled now. Mm. You don't need us anymore, and discharged me from the service. 6 weeks later, having gone from working for a very understanding employer who were, you know, full-time for this employer, this as a PA for a disabled person, where I was spending a lot of time at work. I was doing like 50, 60 hours a week at work, but it was a very relaxed, very, very big position of responsibility, but yet also quite relaxed.
Yeah.
To being a third-year student nurse, my mental health went downhill because I was then having to sit through lectures again.
Yeah.
I was being a third year with all of the pressures that comes with that because of the higher level of study and the higher level of responsibility on placements.
And you're with a different cohort as well. Because
a different cohort. Although it turned out that three students from my previous cohort had also ended up having a year out during my year out that I hadn't known about.
That's
because I actually left the cohort 4 weeks before the end. At the time the accusation was made, I was March cohort and the accusation was made in early February.
Right.
So basically they just said, okay, right, well, we'll mark you as having attended for this period of, because it's not your choice that you're not attending and you've already achieved all your placement competencies.
Mm.
So, you know, you'll probably end up making up this week of your placement, because I missed a week of placement.
Mm.
But at that point, I'd already accrued about 30 hours of doing accidental overtime as a student.
Stuff. Yeah.
You know, I was two full years into my student time anyway. Mm. I'd done 30 hours of overtime as a student.
Yeah, but you always tend to, don't you?
Yeah. So I'd done more than my hours anyway, so they were like, you know, we're just going to mark you as having attended for this time.
Yeah.
You know, we'll sign you off on these hours, but you're not going to come in for your final week of your placement.
Mm.
And then there was 3 weeks of uni, and I was allowed to go to uni in those time, and I did go to uni in those 3 weeks before I then didn't go back for third year.
Right.
So there was about 3 weeks of uni, a week of placement, and then there was like a week of annual leave, But yeah, I started work about a week and a half before I went back to uni for the lectures. It was in that week.
Right.
I managed to I took the job of a friend who had just left the job and has not been they haven't managed to hire someone to replace my friend.
Mm.
So my friend then contacted her former employer and said, "I've got someone to replace me because this person would be really good."
Mm.
And as soon as the police cleared me, the employer was absolutely fine to take me on.
Mm.
I went back to uni and my mental health started deteriorating within weeks. So I went back to my GP, who went, okay, yep, that's fine. I'll re-refer you back into the ADHD service.
Mm.
And in so this was all in like the March sort of time. In September, it still hadn't gone anywhere, but I managed to find the email address of the secretary of the doctor that I now see.
Right.
So I just emailed the secretary directly, and I was like, "How do I get referred into your service? Or how much is it per, you know, per appointment?" Because I knew that they did private practice as well. Found out it was £120 an hour, and that I couldn't possibly afford that.
No.
Went back to my GP again, and I was like, "Look, this is the person to contact." Then ended up via my, because by then I had an NHS email address.
Right.
So I emailed the commissioner for Greater Manchester.
Go to the, if you can't get what you need, go to the top.
Yeah. And I was like, look, these are all the problems I'm having. And about 3 weeks later, I got a letter with an appointment in it. And that was only the first time I've done that.
It's sad that you have to do that sometimes, but sometimes you do, don't
yeah.
you?
Yeah. So I use my NHS email to. With the studentness and the signature and everything, but I emailed the commissioner, and it's as I say, it's only the first time I've done that. The second time was slightly different. I collared him in person when he showed up to an assessment the second time that I did it.
Really? Excuse me, can I just have a quick word?
Yeah.
I did something very similar when Pam was first diagnosed. She was in hospital with her symptoms, which then turned out to be MS, but she was on a medical assessment unit for a day and a half, and then they put her on this general ward, and nobody came to see her. Not one doctor came to see her, because it was from Wednesday night to the Monday morning. Not one doctor had come to see her to tell her why she was there, what was going on, and it approached the fourth day by this point, and I came on the ward, and I saw Pam and said, "Right, have they seen you?" And her eyes were all in two different directions and whatnot. It's on a previous podcast, we talked about it, but I went to see the nurses, and the nurses were actually discussing her case at the out in the open on the corridor. I knew they were talking about her because there were certain things that they were talking about which could only be her. And I basically pulled the head nurse to one side, and I said, "Look, I'm a first year student nurse. I know for a fact I can pull out all the paperwork. I've still got them in my bag. I've just been to university. All the things you've done wrong in this case. She's terrified. She hasn't eaten. You haven't taken her to the toilet. You haven't taken her for a bath. You haven't spoken to her about why she's here."
Yeah.
And within 20 minutes, there's two doctors stood by her bed. And I just think, come on, mate. It's not that hard.
Yeah.
It's basic stuff.
Yeah.
And when you extrapolate that out to an exponential degree, no wonder people get rightly annoyed with the fact that it takes 6 months for an appointment, or you know, your crisis referral gets thrown in the bin. All they could have done, all they needed to do, was refer it to the right person.
Yeah.
It's not hard, is it?
No.
It's so frustrating.
Yeah, I mean, even if they couldn't do the referral to the right person in the case of the crisis team referral, then they could have at least written back to my GP and said.
Absolutely.
But yeah, mistakes get made. Mm. But yeah, it's I then went back to see almost a year after I'd been discharged from the service. Mm. I then turned out that in that intervening year, the doctor that had discharged me, don't know exactly what happened, but knowing a few other people with ADHD in the Cheshire, rural Manchester sort of areas, I do know that everybody else had the same. Everybody else that I know who's met this doctor has had an exact. Not exactly the same experience, but a similarly awful experience with that doctor, and he no longer works for the trust.
Ah. Interesting.
The trust that I then lived under had stopped partnering with that trust and started partnering with the trust that I now work for instead, who also don't employ someone, but do employ this organisation called Adult ADHD Northwest, which has a doctor who works with the trust I now work for, and also with five boroughs.
Right.
So two different doctors. One works in Lee, I think, which is the five boroughs doctor, and the doctor that I think he does actually work for two different trusts. Mm. He only does locum work with the trust I work for.
Mm.
But I've ended up seeing this doctor in Salford now.
Yeah.
So I only have to go as far as Salford now. I don't have to go all the way to Liverpool.
Not quite as far. That's
yeah,
good.
Yeah, I can now get a direct bus from 2 minutes down the road.
Rather than
a bus and then a train and then a 20-minute walk through Liverpool City Centre.
Yeah, crikey.
Um, But yeah, I now see a different doctor who immediately just went, yep, fine, right, I'm going to put you on this dose of meds instead.
Mm-hmm.
And initially I was just, I did stay on the Concerta for a while long on a higher dose. I think I was, I can't even remember, I think I was on 54 in the morning by this point and 45 in the afternoon. Because by this point I could, because that, I was, that when I had that big sort of, well, it wasn't even a big breakdown. I was still mostly functioning. I was just really, really anxious at the same time.
Yeah.
Sorry, I was just looking at the cat. I was still really struggling, but yeah, I had the I was struggling on that 54 milligrams. So by this point, I was on 54 in the morning and 45 in the afternoon, and actually just waking up to realising that I was getting to what, in fact I think I was over the BNF limit by that point.
Yeah,
I think it, yeah, it's because it's 100 and, I think 105 milligrams a day or something of the extended release, so I was on 54 and 45, so I was getting on close to it. You're because I was it, also taking 10 milligrams Ritalin.
Right,
so I was taking 54 milligrams in the morning, 45 milligrams at lunchtime, and then I was coming home and sometimes because this is how much they trusted me. I was given PRN to keep at home.
Right. Again, it's that having that freedom when you've got a consultant who, who understands your needs, isn't it?
Yeah. So I was given the PRN and the pharmacy just go, yeah, do you need it this month? No? Okay. Mm. Or, yeah, you've run out. Okay. When I started, once I started working, that was the difference between third year and actually becoming a fully-fledged staff nurse of I stopped needing it sort of every couple of months and I was using the Ritalin when I came home every single day. Just to be able to cope with the mountain of washing up that needed doing and things. And I think there's something probably we should discuss in a later podcast.
Possibly,
high-functioning, low-functioning.
Absolutely.
Nonsense.
Yeah.
Of just, like, the effort that is required to exist in the world, like, high-functioning... It's not a thing.
Well, I think that might be a good point to pause then, because we've got to the point where you've gone from diagnosis and you've gone all the way up through uni and the trials and tribulations of that, and you're just about to start work, and then
started on new meds after that,
and then we'll pick that up again for the next one where we look at work and high functioning and low functioning from there.
Nice one.
Casey, thank you very much, and Amber the cat, thank you for your contribution as well, very much appreciated.
It's not breakfast time yet.
Thank you very much, and we'll see you for the next one.
Yes.
Cheers. So that was Katie. I'm sure you'll agree that was an absolutely brilliant little introduction with plenty more to come. I'll be posting some pictures of Katie's handwriting as well, because it's absolutely, I've never seen anything like it. I wish my nursing notes looked like that. And also a picture of the beautiful interloper Amber the cat, who made her presence known a few times during that interview. Very, very sweet. As usual, again, please like, comment, subscribe, the usual stuff with podcasts. If you've got anything you'd like to say or you'd like to share, I'm always interested to hear feedback and comments. The podcast is, I'm starting to feel like it's finding its way a little bit. I've kind of got a bit of a kind of theme going a bit, I think, but it's going to change. They always do. I mean, I subscribe to about 30 podcasts, and not a single one sounds the same 100 episodes in than it did at episode one. So I'm just quite keen to go with it and see where it goes and what happens with it. But if you've got any ideas as to how to improve it, how to make it more relevant, I'm absolutely open minded as to making those improvements. I would also like to put a small plug out as well for an artist who I've been following for some time, and hopefully if the wind blows fairly we will be able to meet at some point in the near future. There's an artist on Instagram called Louisa Hammond who is who's just finished her master's dissertation it's called Mental Health Perspectives, and I, at the risk of undervaluing the work that she's done and undervaluing its importance, I would just encourage you to follow Louisa on Instagram and actually just have a look at some of the work that she's created as part of this master's thesis, which deals with representations of what mental illness manifests, how it manifests and how it looks to people using various different artistic media. It's absolutely stunning. There's a couple of images that she's created which really, really resonate with me, and I'm very fortunate that I was able to get hold of a copy of her thesis, which the profits of which also benefit the Mind charity, which is absolutely wonderful. I'm holding the book here, and it's a beautiful piece of art in its own right. So please do follow Louisa, and hopefully in the near future we'll be able to speak to her on the podcast. But the point of this podcast, as soon as I started it, I started obviously looking around and following different people on social media, and there's a few brilliant initiatives like Louise's and a couple of other charity websites and individual artists and comic book authors, and I think the way the podcast is going to change is that it's not just necessarily going to be about mental health, it's about the way we think. The thing is that mental health doesn't have to be mental health problems, it can be different attitudes towards everyday life, and I think as that sort of Venn diagram sort of spreads out a little bit, we'll start seeing how everything's interconnected. And I'm really excited about that, because there's a few things I've got lined up which might seem a bit left field from this kind of original copper plate that we had for the first episode, but I think it's a natural evolution, and I think it's going to be a fun journey. But again, comment, put your feedback through podcast@thinkinghabits.co.uk, and follow me on the socials at Thinking Habits. And as ever, keep talking, and if you need to talk, you know where I am. Bye.